Good morning. Welcome to the House Water Committee. This is Tuesday, April 1. We hope that's not synonymous with anything, today. So we will be hearing a couple of bills, I think, first off this morning, House Bill 3108. And Representative Krieger, would you? You'd read the stuff for us, Pete, and give us a little information on them.
House Bill 3108 requires persons operating a vessel for landing black rockfish, blue rockfish, or nearshore fish to obtain permit, establishes qualifications for obtaining permit, creates permit fees and landing fees, establishes black rockfish, blue rockfish, and nearshore species research account, establishes lottery system to issue permits, defines black rockfish, blue rockfish, and nearshore fish, appropriates money to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife for research on black rockfish and blue rockfish fishery and nearshore fisheries, becomes operated January 1st, 2004, declares emergency effective on planning, on passage.
And before you begin, Representative Krieger, let me ask you a question. Would you like to, after you've given your testimony, have me close this and open the hearing on the other so that you can give both of the things at this time and then proceed with your other duties?
Or? That would be great.
Okay. We'll plan to do that for the audience's note on this. We will, to accommodate Representative Krieger's other schedule, we'll close this hearing recess this hearing and open the hearing on 3534 so that he can give us that testimony and then recess that hearing and go back to this bill 3108. Thank you. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Jensen, committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep from District 1. The issue we're dealing with today has to do, of course, with the commercial fishing industry. I have a great number of those people that I've worked with for 40 years from the time I was a state police game officer. Became very, I guess you might say, actually attached to the people in the industry and have a great knowledge of what they go through. These people are survivors. They've managed to survive. They work in an extremely tough and dangerous environment, and I want you to all understand that I have the greatest respect for them and the industry they come from. As you will hear today, trying to get these people, and some of the commercial fishermen are here, to agree on anything is like herding chickens with a broom. They go everywhere. And that's part of the process that's made this difficult. And we're not going to try to move the bills today simply because we've got some amendments we want to do to accommodate some of their needs and concerns, and we're going to be meeting later today. In April of 2000, 2 years ago during session, I was approached by several of my constituents who had taken part in the nearshore live fishery, and they had a great concern as to what was taking place in that fishery. And that live fishery, that portion of the nearshore, is where these fish are actually caught live, and instead of being worth 35 to 40 cents, 50 cents a pound, they're sold live into California, Seattle, and a few into Portland at anywhere from $2 to $4, $5 a pound. So there's a great enhanced value on that fish being live instead of dead. They expressed a concern as to the growth of this new fishery, and they were of the opinion that it was being overfished, or simply put, it wasn't sustainable with the growth and the number of boats that were coming into it. They at that time requested that I draft a bill, a limited entry bill. Upon checking with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, I found we did not have the needed statistical information regards boats, catch, or stock assessments needed to draft a meaningful bill. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife indicated that the Developmental Fisheries Board could adopt rules to manage the fishery and to control growth. No visible movement had taken place by June of 2002 that I was able to ascertain or took part in. I formed a working group composed of commercial fishermen, Lisa Cobb, a commercial fisherman's wife from Port Orford, Joe Rowletter, and others, and began the process of designing a limited entry bill. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission then came forward with a limited entry program, which was adopted 11-8 of 02 by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission through administrative rule. Upon examination, there were several issues I felt I would discuss or put into my bill in a different manner. They allowed no transferability of the permit when it was issued. which means the boat that would have limited value if it doesn't have a permit attached to it. The bill, as I've got it drafted, allows the transferability of the permit after 5 years if you've taken part in the fishery, and immediately upon the death of the commercial fisherman to a widow or heir, so that that be some value for that permit in the boat. The poundage fees has been an issue. Before, it was something like 2 cents a pound, and in the bill it goes to 5 cents a pound. Huge increase. In this building now, constantly on natural resource issues, we hear that there's a lack of science, a lack of research. The bill prescribes that these dollars go into an account for research. And I've talked to some of the fishermen this morning. I said, you people have to step up and help fund the research that gives us the stock assessments so we have the ability to manage this fishery sustainably and not overfish. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, as far as the renewal of the license, if you were late on making application for your renewal, they've got to be in by December 31st, but let's say you were sick, you were out of town, your mail was lost, you moved, it didn't get to you, you've lost your permit. That could be your way of making a living. I didn't feel that was just. How many of you were late for your committee meeting this morning? That means you're going to lose your position? I would hope not. I think it's a good example. There's some things we cannot change. This bill provides that these fishermen would be able to be notified by a registered letter from the Department of Fish and Wildlife by February 1, and by April they'd have to have the late fee in and a second opportunity to renew that permit. The qualifying dates that the Department of Fish and Wildlife adopted when they did their administrative rule is 1-1 of 97 is the beginning date, and 7-1-02 is the ending date. Within that period, you had to have had 1 year in which you caught 750 pounds. If you didn't, then you were out. Nobody that I've seen likes this, in that not everybody can be in the fishery. But you can't have everybody in the fishery and sustain that resource. They're doing stock assessments now in the blacks and blues, which I'll get to in a second, and we'll know more about that. But if we want to have sustainability of that resource for the communities and the fishermen and some certainty of marketing, then we have to limit who's in there. There has been some concern specifically about the incidental catch. Some call it bycatch, but actually it's incidental catch. That's allowed in the bill, which was allowed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which was 15 pounds per trip. The Salmon Troll people are concerned that that's not enough, that they periodically may take more than that incidentally, and then it would be wasted if they could only. So we are going to meet this afternoon with Patty Burke from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, some of those interested people, and see if we can't come to something that's maybe more reasonable in their minds, but yet still acceptable to the department. What we don't want to do is create targeting on those fish when we're trying to control the numbers that are being harvested. The fees, as I mentioned earlier, have been increased, and there is created in the bill a near-shore research account that provides for those things to go specifically, those dollars go specifically for research and to understand what sustainability is within the industry. The renewal of those permits originally would have required that you had a commercial fish landing of rockfish in the year that you want to renew it each year, which means that if someone was out fishing salmon, was out fishing tuna, and they came back in late September, October, they would have to be going over those small ports on the south coast, for instance, maybe up off of Pacific City, and trying to get their landings, get those five landings or 100 pounds. Why are we wanting people to go out and force them to get a renewal to fish on a species of fish we're trying to cut back on? So instead of requiring the five landings of rockfish, we're simply requiring five commercial fish landings, which means it might be in shrimp, crab, or something else, and it shows that they are actually a viable commercial fisherman. I'm going to leave it there, only to say that we are going to be meeting this afternoon. There will be a couple amendments specifically to incidental catch and transferability of permits. And hopefully we can bring something back to you in a few days that will meet with the approval of the fishermen and yet take care of the resource and the sustainability of it in our communities.
Yeah, any questions for Representative Krieger?
I guess I do, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
And Representative Tomei. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I noticed on page 2, well, I can't see it now, but how do people catch these fish? Are they trollers or using other means of catching these fish?
There's several types of gear that are used. A lot of the live fishery is basically hook and line, with the exception of one person out of Garibaldi, which is with pots. There's a definition of legal gear, which is in the bill that they can use. And it's also the definition that's in the some of the other administrative rules on commercial fishing.
Follow up. What is a pot?
A pot?
Mm-hmm.
It's a device that's like a crab pot or something similar, shaped different, and has okay. places for the fish to go in, and then those are checked periodically.
Okay, so if someone gets, when you're talking about, what was the phrase you used? If I may follow up. Thank
follow
you.
Up.
The incidental fish or whatever it is, the bycatch.
Okay, excuse me.
Yeah.
We got a little catastrophe going on here. Go ahead, please.
Okay. The bycatch, so if somebody's trolling and they catch a fish that they didn't intend to catch, then they would release it, is that correct?
If they were over the 15 pounds, then they would have to release those fish. It's now written. They don't want those particular type of fisheries to target on those fish.
Okay, and the same is true in the pots?
If the pots are specifically for the nearshore live fishery, that's what they catch. There's, I think, 23 fish, they're listed in the bill, which ones are in that grouping of fish that they're allowed to catch as nearshore live. They market those live.
So they follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Okay. Okay, so then the ones in the pots are the ones that are going to be sent live somewhere else. Is that correct?
The pot fishery does that, and also the hook and line fish. They can take those by hook and line, bring them up, and they have live tanks that they put them in. Certain fish have more value than others, so it depends on what their market is, what they're after.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a quick question.
Representative Gangfelder.
Thank you. Representative, I'm assuming that ODF&W is going to come up and testify on this bill, but in your discussions with them, would this require additional staff to issue these permits, or would it be done under the existing staff?
Well, I would assume, Representative Dingfeller, that it would be under the existing staff, because they already have a limited entry program that they adopted through administrative rule, and this is kind of an overlap with a few changes that we're making regarding the application, renewal, poundage fees, transferability, those types of things. They did not indicate that that was going to be a problem, and I believe they're going to probably come up and speak to the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative, I'm going to interrupt the order just a little bit. I see Senator Dukes is here, and she wants to testify on both bills, so I'll let her testify if you will, on this bill, and then we'll go to the other bill, and the both of you can testify that time on that. And you stay right there, Representative. Senator Dukes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Joan Duke, State Senator from District 1, and with your good graces, I brought with me County Commissioner Paul Hanneman, one of two people who actually taught me about fisheries when I first got here in the legislature, as he was already here, and as a fisherman, understood it inside and out. I am here today to testify in opposition to the bill as it is currently written. And mostly my plea for you is to allow us into the process that could possibly shape this bill into something that we could accept. As you're aware, fisheries happen from Astoria to Brookings. And any, let me underscore that, any fisheries bill that we do has to be a discussion from Astoria to Brookings, and this one has not been. In fact, I can guarantee you that I could go out in the docks in Warrenton today, and there would be fishermen who know nothing about this bill. And that concerns me very much, because some of them could be impacted. And as a legislator, I don't know if they're impacted or not until I have the opportunity to do that. There's a lot of stuff in this bill, and I'm not sure that all of it needs to be in the bill. But we, I think, deserve a good discussion about each and every piece of that, because you'll hear today that there are differences of opinion. In fact, I hate limited entry bills, period. There is still blood in certain parts of this Capitol from a bill that we did, and I think it was 95 on limited entry, because you, the state of Washington, you committee members are deciding who gets to make a living and who doesn't get to make a living. Who gets to catch fish and who doesn't get to catch fish? Now move this across the mountains. Do you want to decide who gets to farm wheat and who doesn't? We don't do those sorts of things, but somehow people feel very comfortable doing it when we get out to the coast.
Senator Dukes?
Yes, sir.
Just a brief that's the reason we've got a chair from east of the mountain.
I appreciate that, Senator Representative. Now you've helped me lose my train of thought. You're going to hear differences of opinion about the resource as well. There are people who... bear in mind that this resource is not threatened, nor is it endangered. It's not listed on anybody's list of things that we shouldn't be fishing. But there is some discussion as to whether one of the species may get to that point in the near future. We don't have enough data to know a lot of the answers when it comes to groundfish. We would like more money, and we would like more research, and so that we could get more data, but we don't have it at this point. I'm not going to go into all of the specifics, except to tell you that when you were told that the permit, yes, it will be handled by ODFW, yes, it is a new permit, and it will require some reprogramming, and there's also a poundage fee in here that we don't currently have, and the poundage fee is different than the other poundage fees that are collected for bottom fish, so that one's going to have to be handled separately by the agency. So I hope, if I have conveyed nothing else to you, I've gotten across to you that this is a very complex bill that involves real people who are out there risking their lives to make a living, and that they deserve to be involved in how it is crafted, and I am asking you for the opportunity to let us get involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dukes. And with that, then, we are going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 3108 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3534. And you may just stay
okay.
There if you wish. Representative Krieger.
Chair Jensen, committee members again. This is regard, of course, House Bill 3534. I feel that this bill is crucial to the entire Oregon coast. It is also an important bill for all of Oregon, and most importantly, the sustainability of Oregon ocean resources. The issue of ocean resources, their management, the authority of the federal government, state, and county, has left coastal communities skeptical. What is the Territorial Sea Plan? What is the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Conservation Act? The Oregon Ocean Resources Management Plan, and there's a host of two or three other plans and acts that affect these people. Most Oregonians don't understand it, and they're therefore fearful of what it might mean and who will be making the decisions that will affect their communities and their lives. House Bill 3534 is designed to help provide a fair and level playing field and to see that if a system of limited marine reserves is warranted, that their creation be based on a reasonable science and a criteria with meaningful input from all Oregonians, including the coastal affected stakeholders. The present Ocean Policy Advisory Council, referred to as OPAC, in its present form is unbalanced. House Bill 3534, in this bill, it is corrected, and a fair and balanced council is created. Under OR 196-435, although statutory OPAC only makes recommendations, those recommendations, when adopted into rule by LCDC, obligates all their state agencies to amend their rules to comply with those rules that were adopted. Oregon Parks and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife could have their authority to manage ocean beaches, tidal areas, and fisheries resources basically circumvented. House Bill 3534 prohibits OPAC from taking action or making recommendations establishing fishing seasons, harvest allocation, geographical restrictions, or other harvest restrictions. That is left in the hands of the agency that is charged with that statutory, the Department of Fish and Wildlife. House Bill 3534 originally was going to call for the elimination of the territorial sea plan because it's flawed. We felt that perhaps, and we had a recommendation come from Mr. Kafori, that the territorial sea plan possibly would be better if we had it reviewed by OPAC. So the bill calls for the territorial sea plan to be reviewed by OPAC and then report come back to the legislature on any recommended changes that they might see or inclusions. House Bill 3534 transferred authority to manage ocean resources and establish marine reserves from LCDC, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We're talking about that portion of it that has to do with the fish, the resource, the living resource. It does not transfer the authority to the Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding the things that are underneath the Division of State Lands, drilling, mining, and those types of things, or state parks, which already statutorily give them some authority. It is understood, and I think that common sense and good judgment would indicate that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, with their Newport Marine Lab, their coordination with Oregon State University Research, their work in coordination with the National Marine Fisheries Service, National Ocean Atmospheric Authority, the Federal Fish and Wildlife, Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the Oregon State Police Game Enforcement, is better suited to be the lead agency in managing the living resources in marine reserves. They would also be the agency to use the research data in setting CETAs and closures and quotas. Numerous meetings were held with interested county commissioners, ports, Avalon Tater from the Audubon Society, Mr. Kafori, Native Fish Society, Jim Ryan from the governor's office, who has been extremely helpful in this process, and I feel will continue to be. Ono Hosing of Oregon Coastal Zone Management, and members of the Coastal Caucus we've tried to keep them informed. There is a criteria that's supposed to be met under rules which were adopted by OPAC under the Coastal Zone Management Act, and someone later will speak to that because they were involved specifically in what that criteria was. Those supporting the bill are numerous, and I'll read them at the end. Meetings were also held in recent days with Nan Evans, LCDC, Mike Kerr, State Park, John Griffith, Coos County Commissioner, and again with Jim Myron from the Governor's Office. Numerous emails, letters, phone calls have been considered. I really believe, in fact, that marine reserves will, in fact, come to be in Oregon. I think there's a place for them and possibly a need. The process of how they are created, their acceptance by the coastal communities, in other words, the grassroots, are vital to their success. The sustainability of Oregon resources, our coastal communities, is important if all of Oregon is to have economic opportunity. There are a series of amendments to the existing bill that you don't have that we're going to be working out yet this afternoon with the governor's office and interested parties. I think when we get that done, that most people who are reasonable will be on board. In closing, I want to reference, when I was on the Board of Forestry, Jim Brown gave us a paper, and then I recently got a copy, I believe it's the same thing, called Science 101. And basically what it was to teach board members or legislators that when you hear testimony from people who say what they're telling you is science, is how do you critique that to really know whether that's science or if it's a personal opinion or part of an agenda that they're working on. If you haven't got it and you'd like to have a copy, I think it would help you in all your deliberations, especially on this committee. It's a good piece of work. It makes common sense, and it's fairly short. So if you would like to have it, I'll get it for you. And then maybe perhaps you can use that in your deliberations. No. We'll probably be coming back in a week, within a week with the amendments, and have a pretty good bill.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the representative bit of information to us. I think it would be very helpful.
Okay. If you'd give it to Mr. Test, and he'll make it available then to all members of the committee, which we'll have a test on to make sure that they all read.
Great.
There you go. Thank you, Wayne. Appreciate
okay,
the Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Joan Duke, State Senator from District 16. During the interim, what interim we got, I can recall a conference call of Coastal Caucus members, which is a rarity. We don't normally do that sort of thing or much during the interim. And during that conference call, we all became aware that, and it was there because OPAC was doing some things that made us on the coast very nervous. And we needed to figure out exactly what they had the authority to do and what they didn't have the authority to do and what they were doing and what they weren't doing. And I became aware at that time that this nice little advisory committee to the governor had the authority to cause a state agency to take an action all by themselves. Now, I didn't think that that was what we ever sent advisory committees off to do, and so we became very concerned, and I remember Representative Krieger and I talking about this was something we needed to fix next session. And there's been a growing concern because we have state agencies as full voting members of this committee that is advisory to the governor. And then we have other people who are actually sort of on the ground in the air, living in the areas, who are members, who often feel outnumbered by the state agency people. And so there's been a growing concern that wasn't a good situation. But I think this bill has gone beyond that area, and we just need to continue having discussions about what this bill needs to cover and what it doesn't need to cover and what our goal really is with OPAC. There have been days for all of us when we just wished OPAC would go away. But I don't think you're going to see anybody here, although I could be wrong, recommending that it go away. We believe that there's a useful purpose, or could be if we could get it pointed in the right direction. I will tell you that I think that any marine reserve that ever happens, and that's not all OPEC does. We're just focusing on that because they sort of came in and started doing things without talking to us. But any marine reserve that's established needs to be part of a much bigger picture. A picture that includes watersheds, that includes fisheries, that includes hatcheries, that includes all of the stuff that goes on whenever we have flowing water on the coast. So we need to make sure as we kind of reconfigure this group that they're allowed or required to look at the bigger picture and not just look at one little piece and say we're going to do this in isolation to everything else. So I think we're going to get there on this one. It's just a matter of continuing the dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Are there questions? I guess I have one and one question and one comment. And let me start with the question: what does the bill need to cover?
I think that the bill needs to address the membership on the committee. It needs to address what they have authority to do and what they, and leave out anything that we never intended for them to be doing. And I think it needs to address where they're housed. They are an advisory committee to the governor, and they've sort of been shuffled around. So we need to decide where they're supposed to go.
Okay. Thank you. And my comment was Representative Krieger made reference to fishermen being hard to herd, like chickens with broom or something, if I remember his testimony correctly. And it strikes me that representatives and senators from the from your testimony from the Oregon coast are about like so it's not just peculiar to fishermen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger and I are going to have a conversation because I was sitting in the middle of those fishermen when he made that comment.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate your testimony and taking the time to be with us here today, and let you get back to your other duties. With that, we are going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 3534 and reopen the public hearing on the House Bill 3108. And on our sign-up sheet, I have Paul Hanneman and, is it Ray Moore?
Monroe,
excuse me, from Tillamook. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Chair and members of the committee. It's a privilege to be here with you this morning and talk to you about this bill. I appreciate Representative Krieger's interest and concern and the introduction to the bill. As you notice on the sign-in sheet, we indicated that the bill did need amendments, and I think Senator Dukes and the sponsor have indicated that also. Ms. Chair, with me this morning is Ray Monroe from Pacific City. That's on the North Central Coast. Our interest in the bill is making sure that it benefits and recognizes the entire Oregon coast. Part of our concern is that Mr. Monroe is a veteran of the 1995 wars over the limited entry program for Dungeness crab. He and I were heavily involved in it at that time, even though I wasn't in the legislature anymore then. And it was a session-long battle of which boats were in, which were out. And we don't see this bill as containing the same problems, but we hope that they are not as considerable as that legislation was then. So Ray is also a member of the Salmon Commission and has been active in nearly all offshore fisheries in his lifetime. So, Ms. Chair, with your consent, Ray would make several comments regarding what he believes are necessary to make the bill supportable by all the people from Astoria to Brookings. Ray.
Chair Jensen, my name for the record is Ray Monroe. I'm from Pacific City, Oregon. May I approach with some handouts? My name is Ray Monroe, and I've been a commercial dory fisherman since 1969. I'm from Pacific City, Oregon. I'm also here today as an Oregon Salmon Commissioner. Two of the letters you've just received are from participating fishermen and coastal processors that are family-run businesses from Pacific City, Oregon. The third letter is from a fisherman from Brookings, Oregon, that if 3108 passes today, will no longer be able to land black and blue rockfish. He has been fishing since 1978. Some concerns and considerations for House Bill 3108, sponsored by Representative Krieger. House Bill 3108, as written, does not qualify some fishermen with historical landings of black and blue rockfish. It does not provide adequate incidental catch of Oregon salmon fleet for the Oregon salmon fleet, as Representative Krieger also spoke to. And transferability language is too restrictive. In Section 3, Subsection 1, qualification criteria, I believe other qualifying dates should be looked at to help ensure that long-time commercial fishers are included in the bill along with the most recent participants. In 1994 is when the regulation known as the Oregon Plan was put in place that restricted vessels in most of the state to the landings of 65 fish or 200 pounds of blacks or blues per delivery. For the record, California qualified their fishermen for this nearshore permit using dates of January 1, 1994 to December 31, 1999 to qualify their vessels. You also have that as a handout. The reason I'm bringing that up is that there is a line, the California-Oregon line. Blacks and blues now are regulated by the PFMC, and it might go back to where, if we qualify Oregon with a lesser amount of permits, that we might in fact have California having the most of the catch of the black rockfish. It just might work out that way. It's not that way right now. We're split out on separate quotas, but it can go back. And if California qualifies their fishermen with 200 to 300 permits and Oregon has 73 or 94 active ones, is there a disparity there? There could be. So I believe that the criteria needs to be looked at a little bit more. And then Section 8, Subsection A on transferability. Vessels or fishers nearing retirement could lose their permits in the next 5 years due to lack of participation. Vessels would have to be sold in order to keep permit alive. And with that, as you look at up and down the coast where permits might drop out or fall into place, in Pacific City, for instance, you might look at that criteria that's there that you have that says, looks like Pacific City might have 12 permits issued tomorrow if this bill passed. Well, I know in the people that are in Pacific City, I know that five of those people, one died of a heart attack. We have another one that had a heart attack. We had two more that have retired, so I know those four permits, we don't know where they're at. We just know that they're not going to be accessible to us unless transferability is less restrictive. Saying that, I know that there's four more people that are in their 60s and 70s that are going to retire this year. So, in fact, it might look like we have 12 permits, and we might only end up with four. And in Pacific City, we're the smallest fishers pretty much in the West Coast. We have to have all the permits we can get, because once they're gone out of there, we don't get them back. We can't afford to buy a permit that's on a 35-foot or 40-foot boat and put it back on our 22-foot vessels. We just can't afford that. We have an accessibility problem to the ocean. We have to go through the surf. The ocean has to be good. Our boats are 22 feet and only hold about 1,000 pounds of product. I have to have in my port to survive, and you'll see the letters of support from our two buyers that are there. We've got to have everybody. From 1995 through 2001, those fishermen have changed. So the landings that are there that you see, it might be five different fishermen from any 1 year to the next. The research fee. The only thing I want to address about the research fee is that if you're getting a $4 to $5 a pound fish, 5 cents isn't very much. We get 65 to 70 cents for our dead fish. We don't land them live. We don't have live fish permits in Pacific City. We got zero. There's six in the North Coast. We didn't get any. We didn't get any because we didn't meet the qualification criteria. So I'm just letting you know that we don't get $4 a pound for our fish. We get 65 to 70 cents. So a nickel a pound could make a big difference to a guy.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Representative Domey.
Thank you. These are issues that are not at all familiar to me, so I'm probably going to be asking questions that other people understand. But how do people get qualified so that they can catch live fish?
You had to land live fish in the criteria year. From 1997 through 2001 of, I believe, 750 pounds or 500 pounds, whatever it was.
You follow up.
Follow up.
So you would have had to have landed live fish during that period, and if you didn't, then you don't qualify to get this permit to catch live fish.
That is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
In closing, well, the proposed bill, as is, will definitely, in my port and area, have an adverse economic impact directly affecting some small businesses. Marty Johnson stated, as a fish buyer fisherman, and small seafood market on the coast. Further reductions in either rockfish quotas or fishermen will certainly jeopardize our ability to adequately stock our seafood market with local fish we depend on. They're buying tilapia now. I mean, it's not because we're restricted, but because the ocean conditions have been so severe, we have just barely could start getting out in the winter. I also, for the record, went to the PFMC and had a special season cut out to only let us fish 6 months at a time. And so at that time, some fishermen would have dropped out from this criteria. That's why I still believe we need to look at the qualification criteria. In closing, I'm asking the committee chair, Jensen, to please not move this bill out of committee until our needs and concerns are addressed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Monroe. Appreciate your testimony. Very quickly.
Yes. Oh, it's okay. Actually, my question is a selfish one more than it is to do with this bill, but you've been fishing since 1969?
Yes.
So you've obviously been observing fish for a long time at the coast. I love to fish off the coast, and all I get is what I read in the paper. So I'm going to ask you, and Senator Dukes alluded to wheat farmers. Sometimes farmers let their land grow fallow for a year or two so it gets a better yield. In your experience, have you seen the bottom fish or ground fish populations go up and down throughout your years of fishing? And are you concerned, I know you're concerned, do you think there's any evidence of this fishery being fished out? Because from a selfish perspective, I certainly don't. I'm a recreational fisherman, so I just wanted to get your observation on that, please.
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler. I've seen the rockfish availability not be in front of us to catch at times, but not necessarily that it wasn't there somewhere else in the ocean. Just for instance, and I do not believe that our product in the ocean is on a downturn. I think it's on the upswing. Ocean conditions are great, and I think all rock fishery and flatfish and salmon as well are on the rise. I believe somewhere in the early 90s, Pacific City landed over 400,000 pounds of black rockfish just in our port. It's somewhere in that time frame. We are restricted now on the whole west coast from the Oregon border to only 112 metric ton. So I think that the restrictions by the federal, by the PFMC has put in place, I don't see any problem with overfishing anymore. There's just, it's been restricted. The trawl boat fleets are gone or just about virtually out of business. That's why we don't have any black rockfish on our coast now, or any rockfish per se. They don't catch black rockfish, but there's nothing left. I mean, we don't have any entry. We don't have people. We need people, and the fish are there. We're seeing teams and teams of fish. If you come to my port and just, you could sit there and look at them, and they don't bite. We have to fish with a hook and line. I just believe that they're not in trouble. And I think that these studies coming out next month are going to show that on the black rockfish.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Paul?
Ms. Chair, Mr. Monroe attends our federal council meetings, too, as a representative from our port, is the reason that he's fairly knowledgeable on the federal side, too. And thank you so much for the courtesy of appearing this morning before you.
Well, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you. And with this, we now are going to interrupt the schedule. We have Secretary Bradbury here to testify. Welcome, Mr. Secretary. I'm not sure which bill or...
3531.
You're going to be testifying on 3534, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So with that, we will adjourn the... We will recess the hearing on 3108 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 3534. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for providing me this opportunity to talk about the Ocean Resources Management Program. Chair Jensen and members of the committee, I really do appreciate the opportunity to testify today. And I want to start by just saying that it's my understanding that the bill's chief sponsor, Representative Wayne Krieger, has worked with the interim director of DLCD, Ann Evans, to develop some significant amendments that narrow the focus of the bill some and keep Oregon a national leader in developing state ocean management policy. So I just wanted to indicate that I haven't seen all the details of the amendments, but those amendments sound like very good direction. But I want to tell you why. As a coastal senator, that's what I used to be before I was Secretary of State, I want to tell you why I sponsored the bill in 1987 and again in 1991 to create Oregon's Ocean Policy Program. When I came to the legislature for the first time in 1981, representing Coos and Curry counties, which is the same district that Representative Krieger now represents, I actually was surprised to learn that not only did I represent all the land, but I also represented the first 3 miles of the ocean, because the territorial sea is in fact owned by the state of Oregon, and for the whole coast that adds up to about 1,200 square miles of ocean that is in fact owned by the state of Oregon.
Mr. Secretary?
Yes.
How many votes did you get out of that?
I think I would confess that's probably why I wasn't real focused on the fact that I represented the ocean, because there weren't too many votes coming from sea lions and seagulls.
Thank you.
In 1983, it was very interesting because the federal government proposed exploration and possible development of oil and gas in federal waters not far offshore in Oregon, and Governor Attia and state agencies scrambled to develop a strategy and policy to respond to this federal initiative. And at about the same time, the Reagan administration proposed, and I don't know how many of you remember this, but they proposed deep ocean mining off the Oregon coast. And I produced a documentary on ocean mining, deep sea ocean mining on the Gorder Ridge is what it was called. And not long after that, proposals were laid on the table to explore for minerals in the seafloor within state waters in my district along the southern Oregon coast. And needless to say, I and my constituents were more than a little bit concerned about this possibility. So I have to tell you, I will never forget the public hearing that was held on these proposals in Port Orford, which many of you probably, maybe you've been to Port Orford, but it's a town of about, I think it's about 1,500, maybe 1,500 people now. And it was a collection of fishermen, environmentalists, and just regular citizens in Port Orford. And there were folks that came there from all over the coast, and they were all very upset about these federal proposals, because for them, it was a matter of being able to sustain their fisheries and therefore their communities, because those communities were dependent on the renewable resources. They knew that renewable resources are much more valuable in the long run than non-renewable resources, renewable resources like fish as opposed to developing minerals and oil and gas. They knew that the boom and bust of minerals and oil development would leave them worse off in the long run. Now, Oregon already had State Planning Goal 19, which governs ocean resources, and it has a very strong, it has strong conservation policies, and it has a very clear preference to renewable resources. Now, although we knew it was a great state policy, we faced a tremendous challenge in determining how to apply the standards of Oregon's Ocean Resources Goal 19, to proposed federal actions. Because how do we relate our goal, state law, to federal action? And how can that then affect offshore oil development and undersea mineral development? We knew that Oregonians wanted sustainable long-term conservation of the marine environment and the economies that depend on that environment. Ocean fisheries provide long-term renewable sustenance in contrast one-time mining of oil, gas, and minerals would be a big boom, but then bust, with the potential for very real long-term damage to our marine resources. It was clear that we as a state needed a better way to organize ourselves to represent public concerns and protect the long-term resources of our ocean. State waters or federal waters, it really didn't matter because it's all one ocean. There were more than, and these, there were more concerns than just a concern for the environment. These were bread and butter concerns to my constituents. So in 1987, I worked with a bipartisan coalition of House and Senate members to set up an ocean task force. Its job was to evaluate the many issues facing Oregon's ocean and its resources, assess whether Oregon had the tools to do the job, and then make recommendations on how best to plan for and manage our ocean resources. After 4 years of hard work and a lot of listening to the public, the task force recommended that Oregon set up an ongoing ocean resources program. That recommendation was the basis for my 1991 legislation that is the law that we're dealing with today. Both the House and the Senate overwhelmingly supported this legislation, and they supported the ocean program. A key part of the program is the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, OPAC. OPAC is in the office of the governor, and it creates a big table to bring together a wide variety of ocean interests meeting with state agencies. Now, we put it in the governor's office and not in a single agency because the governor oversees all of the resource agencies, and he is the point person for the state on a broad range of ocean issues, especially when dealing with the federal government. We directed the Ocean Policy Advisory Council to adopt a plan for the territorial sea and amend it over time as needed. But because the council is advisory only, and I want to emphasize that, the council is advisory only with no authority to regulate anything, we directed that the plan be reviewed and approved by the Land Conservation and Development Commission as part of the state's coastal management program. Now, by attaching the ocean program to the Department of Land Conservation and Development, it was not without controversy. I can remember criticisms of me. Here I was trying to zone the ocean. But there was a real thought behind this, and it wasn't that we wanted to zone the ocean. Basically, what it was is by doing it through DLCD, we ensured that the plan that the Ocean Policy Advisory Council developed, that plan was reviewed and adopted by LCDC, we ensured that that plan would have effects on lots of different state agencies, whether it be state parks, whether it be transportation, and it would have effect on them under state law, and it would have effect on federal agencies under the requirements of the National Coastal Zone Management Act. And I just really want to emphasize, this is the fundamental key to this legislation, is it gives this state some say with the federal government and the management of the ocean off our shores. Now, once Oregon's ocean plan was approved by the federal government, and it has been, as meeting national requirements, federal agencies have to act under the guidelines we've created in our plan. Thus, we would achieve one of our most important goals, that federal actions be consistent with Oregon's ocean plan. Now, let me just say that again, because this really is the key that we were looking for to have state policy affect federal policy. All you have to do, I would invite any of you to go to a hearing in Port Orford where people are talking about the federal government doing offshore oil development right off the coast, and understand the frustration of people feeling that they have no significant way to influence this huge monolith, the federal government, as it pursues this oil and gas policy. And we've found a way to do that through the Oregon Ocean Plan. So, as I said, the federal government has now accepted Oregon's Ocean Plan. It went through a process at the Office of Coastal Zone Management. And the fact is, this has given Oregon citizens a say over federal actions on our coast. Now, the Territorial Sea Plan that has been adopted and approved by the feds contains clear standards for assessing the effects of ocean development that would affect the marine environment. These standards are in place today as the Bush administration seeks to lift the moratorium on oil and gas exploration along the Pacific coast. So this issue is going to rise again, it sounds like. And these standards also guide agencies like federal agencies like the Corps of Engineers in disposing of dredged sediment in the ocean, which is always an issue with any kind of river improvement, whether it be the Columbia, Coos Bay, or Newport. OPAC spent 2 years in an open public process assessing the issue of marine reserves at the request of the last governor. The council understood that its job was to provide a carefully considered policy recommendation on marine reserves, but they also knew that far more work was needed to address many, and I underline many, concerns before any reserves were identified. And OPAC's recommendation provides the governor with a policy, with some objectives, and a plan to bring people and communities into a collaborative process, find the funding, apply sound science, and protect our marine resources. I know that that's been a huge source of controversy, but I would really ask you to look at where are we today with that effort. In addition, the council has amended the Territorial Sea Plan with groundbreaking policies that require submarine cable companies to work with Oregon's fishermen to avoid conflicts and pay for damage to fishing gear. These simple but effective policies have set a new worldwide standard and made Oregon a desirable place for cable companies to invest in operations, because we found a way to meet the needs of the fishing community and also meet the needs of the cable companies. And the Oregon Ocean Program has once again placed Oregon as the head of the pack nationally. The Oregon Ocean Program is being considered by the National Commission on Ocean Policy as a model of how government ought to organize its agencies, its policies, and its executive to manage ocean resources. Oregon has demonstrated to the National Commission that a state can be an effective and proactive partner in national ocean management, not simply an obstructionist. So today, I would urge you to preserve the Oregon Ocean Resources Management Program and thereby keep Oregon's influence over our ocean. And I hope that after the next dozen years, you'll be able to look back at this session and appreciate that your efforts helped to strengthen the protection and management of our ocean resources. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any questions?
Mr.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I really appreciate the historical background, especially to a newbie here. I do have a question. Senator Joan Duke testified that her concern was that OPAC has power to cause a state agency to do something all by itself, whereas in what I understood you to say, that it's advisory under the governor in his office and has no power to implement policy change. So I'm
I'm a little confused, if perhaps you could help me.
I will try. Chair Jensen, Representative Flores. OPAC as a body does not have regulatory authority. OPAC as a body has the authority to recommend to the Land Conservation and Development Commission that policies relating to the ocean be adopted. Now, LCDC clearly has the authority because of the requirements that were enacted in the original Senate Bill 100 in 1973. There are requirements that other agencies' actions be consistent with the plans and policies adopted by LCDC. So OPAC itself doesn't have that regulatory authority, but once the plan is adopted, it then is part of this overall state the overall state plan, and that then is subject to the consistency requirements that would affect state agencies.
Thank you. One follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Just a little bit different take now then. You also indicated that the plan, as you had originally crafted it, had the provision for modification from the time of its inception forward. Now, has OPAC plan been modified over the years?
My understanding is that yes, they've met and made some changes, and over time. But like I say, any changes they propose have to be directed to the Land Conservation and Development Commission. So yes, my understanding is that a plan needs to be a living document that keeps up with the times, and my understanding is they have made some changes over time, and they've proposed those to the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Other questions? One question, Mr. Secretary. In your view, and I realize there are very few people in this building that have a closer and longer touch with this particular topic than you do, so we appreciate your taking the time and the wisdom that you bring to us on
this.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair.
We often talk about legislative history, and we don't often have this much legislative history in the front court.
For which I apologize, Mr. Chair.
For which we're grateful. But one of the things, or one of the issues that has been that I've heard in relationship to this bill is has to do with the marine reserves, and has to do with the questioning of whether LCDC has the really biological technical expertise to deal with that, and suggest that those things are more appropriately those decisions would be more appropriately vested in Department of Fish and Wildlife, which happens to have technical biological experts to make the decisions. How would you respond to that, I guess, to
Mr. Chair? I would respond that an absolutely critical part of making any decision on marine reserves would be having the full participation of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, because they are the experts on the ocean fishery. So that's critical. I think that it's critical that they be involved in making those kinds of decisions, like the controversial one relating to marine reserves. That needs to be real. There's a lot of science that goes both ways on that. So, it's real clear to me that it makes more sense to have a coordinating agency responsible for final plan adoption, rather than a specific agency focused A, on the fisheries, B, on the parks, C, on marine navigation. It's like the challenge is to find an agency that involves all those other agencies in making a coordinated decision. I think clearly Fish and Wildlife has a very significant role in the issue of marine reserves.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And again, Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I have a question since you're our institutional memory on this bill.
I'm getting old.
As you sit there.
Yes. Regarding the makeup of the membership, because there's also a lot of discussion about changing the membership. And can you talk a little bit about how it was originally decided on membership of the committee, voting versus non-voting members, and if you have any comments, I don't know if you've seen the proposed changes to the membership, but I think it'd be interesting to hear the history about why certain folks were selected.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, it's my understanding that there have been amendments proposed. Representative Krieger, working with Nan Evans from DLCD, there are some amendments proposed that would make state agencies, what do you call it, ex officio rather than voting members. That seems fine to me. I think that's traditionally the way we do things, is we don't have state agencies normally state agencies aren't voting members of a board or commission. They're ex officio providing information so that the people who are voting members can make informed decisions. And I think that makes a whole lot of sense. And I don't know what I don't remember real clearly what led to the creation of the OPAC with agencies voting and the public voting. I don't remember. I know that I'm going to give you a little bit longer answer maybe than you wanted, but I know that one of the things that really strikes you when you look at how we approach, or at least how we used to approach, and I think we still do, approach the ocean, is that there are lots of agencies that have little pieces of responsibility, whether it be some of them aren't so little. Fish and Wildlife has fishery management and intertidal shellfish management, and state parks has beachfront and parks, and transportation has the marine navigation, and I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting, but they're all very specific and very, they have their own little part of the larger reality. And so there was a real interest in making sure that all the various agencies that were involved participated in the development of this plan. And that may be what led to, the law, I don't even know, the law may say, they're, I don't know what the, I don't remember well enough, but the law may say that they're voting members. I don't know. But I think it makes sense to create a more normal kind of committee where you don't have state agencies vote and you have members of the public and a broad representation of the public on the Ocean Policy Advisory Committee and go at it that way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate again your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to spout off a little.
Back to a subject that was near and dear to your heart. With that, we will recess the public hearing on House Bill 3534 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3108. And we have Don Stevens to testify on House Bill 3108.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Don Stevens. I reside at 4505 East Portland Road in Newburgh. I'm a retired salmon troller with experience trolling salmon, halibut, lingcod, and rockfish. I'm currently a member of the Regulatory Committee to the Oregon Salmon Commission, the State of Oregon Commodity Commission, and chairman of the Salmon Advisory Subpanel to the Pacific Fishery Management Council. I'm here today to speak against House Bill 3108 as it is currently written. Problems with House Bill 3108 as written include, and there's several bullets on your handout here, One is lack of compliance with national standards, number 2, 4, 6, 8, and 9 of the Magnuson Fishery and Conservation Act. Science, or lack of science, used to determine the number of pounds of black rockfish, there's a spelling error there, as incidental harvest without one of these permits. A total lack of equitable harvest distribution of black rockfish based on gear types and geographic location. Lack of consideration of variations by year, ocean conditions, fish abundance, and season structures. Potential unattended reduction of ocean salmon trolling opportunity through erroneous assumptions of incidental black rockfish landings. This is a key point.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Could I ask for an explanation of that, please? What does that mean? Why would that affect salmon trolling?
Well, if I have the same copy of House Bill 3108 as you do, line 27 on page 1 limits a person operating a vessel to 15 pounds of black or blue rockfish per landing. In my testimony here, I'll get into that later, but history, which I go back to 1971 when I started fishing, black rockfish are an incidental catch to the salmon troll fishery from Nia Bay, Washington, all the way into Central California. Recent years, we haven't had any coho fisheries because we've been protecting OCNs, so we haven't been fishing the near shore. This is a near shore bill. We've been fishing offshore. We have less incidental contact with black rockfish, as well as we've changed our gear array. So we're fishing 4 hooks of wire instead of an unlimited number of hooks per wire. So the potential then is bycatch. This is what the federal council is. If you look at the page 3 of the handout, has the national standards listed on them, and number 9 is to minimize the bycatch or mortality from bycatch. Okay, we have in our fishery an incidental halibut catch. We're allowed so many halibut per salmon during a certain time of year based on a quota. Currently, we have a 65 black rockfish or 200 pounds of black rockfish that can be landed in a salmon troll fishery, and this bill would take that to 15 pounds. Well, if we get into a bycatch scenario, we could shut the troll fishery down based on bycatch.
I see. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To continue on, prohibition of allowable landings through unique coastal geography, Pacific City and Port Orford are two examples. Disallowing a reasonable incidental landing of black rockfish while targeting other species of fish encourages bycatch or mortality from bycatch. Again, the last page of the testimony has the national standards printed on them. House Bill 3108 has become much more of a concern than it should be at this time. It is very premature to do anything on management of black rockfish until April 21st of 2003, and the Black Rockfish Assessment Meeting of the STAR Panel of the Pacific Fishery Management Council will be held in Santa Cruz. After that date, a published report will be available to guide the state and federal managers in their pursuit to follow the 10 national standards. These national standards, as written, provide the backbone of the fishery management in the United States. It is at this time I must point out Oregon salmon trollers' concerns in the way House Bill 3108 is written and would ultimately be applied to the Oregon salmon troll industry. Oregon salmon trollers fish from as shallow as 6 fathoms near Garibaldi, Oregon, which I participated in for many seasons, to well off the continental shelf. Since 1993, Oregon trollers south of Cape Falcon have not fished for coho salmon, but have adjusted their fishing patterns as well as their array of gear to reduce encounters. We are currently targeting Chinook salmon with 4 hooks per line in an attempt to avoid coho, particularly Oregon Coast natural coho. And an additional achievement of this gear reduction has lowered Oregon salmon trolls' contacts with rockfish. Trollers' impacts on PFMC rockfish stocks of concern, canaries, yellow eyes, and picacho, to name a few, have diminished to where the PFMC last September adopted a status quo option that allows salmon trollers trolling as it is currently conducted. The status quo option was also adopted for California and Washington troll fisheries. House Bill 3108, as written, would allow only a landing of 15 pounds of black rockfish by salmon trollers per trip. Currently, state rule allows the retention of 65 black rockfish or 200 pounds per landing. ODF&W attempted to do an analysis using only one data point when traditional coho fishing occurred, that being 1991. The 91 coho opportunity produced the least pounds of incidental rockfish that were landed from 87 through 92, the last 6 years of coho opportunity that was allowed to Oregon trollers. It should be noted that 1991 also produced the least number of Chinook harvested at 74,600 compared to a high of 523,800 in 1987. Accordingly, more rockfish were landed in all years except 1991, the year the department chose to do their analysis. I should say that they also did an analysis in recent years, but we're not fishing the near shore, so it didn't show anything, any catch of black rockfish, any substantial catch. ODF&W's selective analysis indicated only 15 pounds of black rockfish per trip were necessary to fulfill the needs of the Oregon Salmon Troll fleet. ODF&W did a similar analysis for 95 and 2002 and came to the same conclusion. The Oregon Salmon Troll fleet feels differently about ODF&W's findings. This analysis borders on no science. In the Klamath Fishery Management Model, or the KOHM alone, which is what drives the Chinook fishery off the coast of Oregon, we use 20,000 data points. Not one. We use 20,000 data points going all the way back to 1981 to determine what our opportunity is going to be or what our impacts are on what stocks are available in the salmon fishery. With the current high ocean conditions and record spawning numbers of OCN coho, it is anticipated that Oregon trollers will again be harvesting coho in substantial numbers, and their fishery will move closer to the near shore and occur at times where black rockfish are more readily available. Our concern is to avoid bycatch of black rockfish in the upcoming salmon opportunities for commercial trollers and provide a reasonable incidental catch. Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission adopted groundfish trip limits and management measures in 1995. Specifically, this rule was done because of a new black rockfish assessment and other relevant data. The key is the new black rockfish assessment. The new assessment won't be completed until the 21st of April, next month. And then there'll have to be the permit, or the report will have to be written and passed out and go through review. National standard number 9 to minimize bycatch or mortality from bycatch is a top priority for Pacific Fishery Management Council. I spoke with a staff officer yesterday at PFMC. At this time, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Salmon Commission representative have not agreed to an incidental landing limit when trolling salmon. That's on black rockfish. We have talked once on this issue. We plan on talking again after this hearing. There is an amendment. It's underlined and it's in dark print from the Salmon Commission, and we would like this amendment considered. A person operating a fishing vessel engaged in salmon trolling will be allowed an incidental landing of 65 black rockfish or 200 pounds, whichever is greater, from a single fishing trip, provided salmon are on board the fishing vessel. This will eliminate any trolling for black rockfish or direct targeting for black rockfish from salmon boats. You would have to have salmon on board. There are many other parts of 3108 that need to be changed, but they've been spoken to today in testimony, and I'm sure will be spoken to later. If we have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Mr. Chairman, please.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So if I got this right, in your 30-some years of being involved in this industry, the gear you use, technology you use, has changed, and you've made efforts to avoid incidental rockfish while trolling for salmon. That's correct?
Well, the dynamics of the fishery have changed.
And this is where I'm getting, actually. In your opinion, fish move, Lord knows that. You think the 15 pounds, first of all, was taken from a too small of sampling, and it's too rigid because one day you might catch 200 incidental, and then another day, if you're further out somewhere, you could probably catch maybe even zero, I'd imagine. So you think it needs to be a little more flexible than 15 pounds?
Correct. The black rockfish live from the beach out to 200 fathoms. All the scientific data, you know, proves that they're stratified throughout the water column. They're available. They are concentrated more on the beach in the near shore inside 27 fathoms. Mm-hmm. There's a few small Chinook fisheries that occur on the Oregon coast inside of 27 fathoms, mostly in the fall, September at Garibaldi. Then we have an Elk River fishery into December. Brookings has an October fishery. But most of the fishing currently is occurring offshore, somewhere outside of where the normal abundance of black rockfish is. And I happen to agree with Raymond Rowe. I think this stock abundance is going to come back and show that these fish are on the upswing, that there are more fish available than there have been in the past. And also you have to look at our fleet. We had 1,200 boats fishing in 1991. Last year we had 467 boats fishing, and that's kind of been the average between 450 and 550 the last several years. It's more of a professional fleet. They're more targeting on the Chinook, trying to avoid the coho, but we're going to go back to coho fishing. And with the matrix that's put together by the Pacific Council, we're not going to be fishing selectively. There's going to be enough coho around there that we're going to have a directed fishery at least in 2005, some number of fish. And I anticipate 75 to 100 boats coming back into the fishery that were displaced coho fishermen, maybe part-time fishermen, and they'll move closer to the near shore to fish. So I feel that 15 pounds is not enough. And I talked to Representative Krieger this morning and made a counteroffer in his office. And I've also talked to the department, and we're going to meet again after this hearing and try to come to some agreement that both parties can work with, and probably put a caveat on. Just one more point.
We're looking at 27 minutes of committee time to hear about 40 people.
Okay.
And some of these conversations could take place, if you would, in the, you know, with the representative in the hall, or representatives in the hall, and actually appreciate very much your knowledge and your willingness to share that with us. It's the economics as such, we just are not going to be able to get through perhaps this bill, let alone the other bill that we were scheduled to hear today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I look forward to my first incidental catch of a halibut. Can't wait for that one.
At this point, and Janice Green and Dennis Ritchie, and I would ask folks that people coming up to testify not to try to avoid the duplication of testimony that you've heard in others, and also maybe to try to summarize and move as quickly as we can. And Janice, I don't like to start with you to do that, because you're always so kind and right to the point on issues. So please.
My name is Janice Green. I'm with the Recreational Fishing Alliance. I should say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I have with me today Mr. Ritchie from Oregon Anglers. And Mr. Ritchie is going to talk about what we would like to see with this bill, and then I'll finish up.
As representatives of Oregon Anglers and the Recreational Fishing Alliance, we represent a lot of sports fishermen. And it's clear that the requirement of Section 3, 750 pounds of landing in any one of the four calendar years, sets forth how many boats will participate in the commercial black and blue rockfish fisheries and limits new participants. That's generally the intent. We feel, given the pressure from decreasing fisheries elsewhere, this is a good position and a good provision. But we'd like to have Section 3 limited to a period from now through the end of 2005. The bottom line is that we don't have adequate information. That information should come soon. It's amazing how many different bills that are floating around now are intertwined. You will be hearing a bill later about having a $10 fee on sports fishing bills, which will give us more money to gather more information for all these bottom fishing stocks. But We also would like to see the landing requirements for transferring a permit under Section 8 be greater than the bycatch allowance for such as salmon trawlers. We think this could also be left until after December 31st, 2005, to a matter of rule by the commission, and ask that the law should directly specify this commission responsibility.
Okay. Roughly, the reason this bill, we support this bill, is that we have a ballooning live fish fishery. They're having a great deal of trouble with it in California. This will limit the participants, and it clearly does that in the black rock fish. The participants in the live fish fishery have already been limited. And what the department has already done did not, however, address commercial black rock fish. The reason we're for this bill is that the commission has already, by rule, limited commercial black rock fish, which is an important sport species, to certain sections of the coast. Mostly in the North Coast, they have limited black rock fish to recreational fishing, and in the South Coast, they have limited black rock fish fishing to commercial. So they've sectioned off the ocean. So we're protected in this case. So that's why we're for this bill, to protect our fishery from people coming up from California or people being displaced because of the groundfish disaster into the black rock fish fishery. And this will protect us from that while we get to the point where we know more, and where if you took my my suggestion here, the commission could address these questions. The other part of my presentation has to do with the fact that these things are so complicated, so miserable, so that I would recommend that you go ahead and protect us for now, but kick this to the commission for the long term, for doing the planning with all the fishermen, everybody involved, all the sport fishermen, the commercial fishermen, the North Coast fishermen, the South Coast fishermen, the ports, and everybody. The commission is very good at that. They had a three-year process that resulted in the regulation we now have. It was a very good process. We were very happy with it. Other than that, I just wanted to mention the tables, because I know that all of you are very interested in economic information. And just wanted to mention that recreational fishermen spend over $500 million in Oregon every year, annually.
Just the marine fishermen.
This is just the marine fishermen. Excuse me? Just the marine fishermen. We have a pretty good tourist mix with that. We have 20% of our marine angler days are tourism. Washington only has about, 10%. California only has about 10%. So we have a lot of tourists. I have another table here that shows the economic impact on the coast of commercial fishing. I only have that because I'm interested in your realizing that recreational fishing has a huge impact on the coast. But when you have a bill like this, you don't even know that recreational fishing exists. And yet, we're probably more important economically than the commercial fishing, the way things stand now anyway. I know I've said this before, but to put this in perspective, this data here is based on a landed value in the commercial fishery of $68 million. Okay? The onion harvest in Oregon is $74 million. The onion harvest. So the farm gate value in Marion County is over $500 million. That's economic clout. And we're talking an industry, the fishing industry, which is really in serious decline, is having a lot of trouble. And if we don't attend to sport fishing, we will not be helping the coastal economy because there aren't any more fish for commercial fishing to grow. So all you can do, excuse me, is grow recreational fishing. So, and I think these tables kind of indicate that. We had more bottom fish trips than we had salmon trips.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Janice. Next we have Patty Burke and Kay Brown from Department of Fish and Wildlife. Ms. Burke, Ms. Brown, you've heard the comments on the time element. So if you could summarize as best you can for us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kay Brown. I am the Fish Division Operations Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And with me is Patty Burke, who is the manager for our marine program. We had written comments, but in light of the fact that it appears there will be additional meetings and amendments to this bill, we're choosing not to submit those at this time. What we did want to do is just let you know that House Bill 3108 provides for a new limited entry program for commercial fishing, similar to a number of other limited entry programs that are in place currently. These programs limit the ability of individuals to participate or not participate in fishing, such as salmon, crab, and those kinds of things. We've been working with Representative Krieger and providing him with technical assistance on this bill, and have reviewed the language as it has been moving forward to assure that we have that the bill would provide administratively workable permit program should it be adopted. And we are here simply to answer any questions that you might have relative to this fishery. I know commercial fishing is probably not an area that you're particularly familiar with, so I'm happy to answer any questions for you. And with that, we're here to answer questions.
Does any of the committee members have some quick questions for ODF&W? Okay, I just have one that I had asked the representative regarding staffing, and can you administer this program under your current staffing levels?
Representative Dingfelder, there is no question that any time you change a permit system or add a permit system, there are administrative costs. Until we know the scope of this program and what is what the bill will actually entail, I can't tell you exactly how much it will involve, but we do have some concerns relative to modifications of our computer system at a time when we're in the process of moving to Salem, and there's a lot of activity involved in that as well. So our staff time is particularly limited right now to involve itself in any kind of a new program. So we do have some issues there. I can't tell you at this point what that would be.
Okay, and this bill has an emergency clause, so it would be effective before the end of the year.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. I'd like to call Lucy Labonte up, please. Actually, I'm going to ask Scott Bailey and Ralph Brown all to come up at the same time since we're short on time.
Thank you. And actually, we have testimony on both bills. I don't know if we can recess one and do that for us like we did for the other elected officials, but no. We'd sure like
to do both of them today. For the record, can you just state your name?
Sure. My name is Commissioner Lucy Labonte. I'm chair of the Curry County Commission housed in Gold Beach.
Great. Thank you.
So I'll start with the nearshore fishery bill, since that's the one I guess we're hearing right now. I have a very short statement to read from the Curry County Board of Commissioners. The Curry County Board of Commissioners supports a cap on the boats in the nearshore live fish fishery. The Curry County Commissioners attended a series of meetings that were held in Curry County over the past few years to receive public input on a cap on boats in the nearshore live fish fishery. The large majority of the public present in all of the meetings was in favor of a cap. Without the cap, we believe there will be an impact on the fishery resource. The state of California has recently adopted management regulations within the state waters on nearshore fisheries. There's a concern that vessels displaced from the California nearshore fishery will move into Oregon. Without a cap, our resources and our economy will be impacted. We've noticed a large increase in live fish boats, both in Gold Beach and in Port Orford. We've been asking for over 2 years for ODFW to do something about it. They didn't do anything. We were going to have a bill last legislative session. ODFW was going to take care of it. They didn't do anything. And that is why Representative Krieger has moved forward with a bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. I'm going to have gentlemen give your testimony, and then if we can hold questions just to the very end. Mr. Boley?
Yes, my name is Scott Boley. I'm a fisherman from Gold Beach, Oregon, and we also a partner in a fish processing facility. We fillet black rock fish and sell them to the general public, provide restaurants, local restaurants, with local seafood products to feed the tourists that support our tourism economy. So commercial fishing is very important towards the overall economic impacts to the coast. Many people come to eat fish. I support the limited entry bill. For perspective, we have a nearshore fishery which has limited resources. It's compressed against the shore. It's not spread throughout the ocean. It's only in discrete areas. We have a fishery that's developed, which is an excellent value-added fishery, the live fishery. By taking extra care and trouble to keep those fish alive, you receive a lot more dollars. We're pumping a lot of dollars into the Curry County economy, which is really needed. We do need to make sure that fishery is sustainable, so we needed to limit those boats. We tried to do this last session. We were premature. We come back this session to try to fill the holes. The department, in the meantime, has put forward, by administrative rule and through the commission, a nearshore plan which limits the number of boats, but it leaves a hole, and that is in black and blue rockfish, and it also had some other deficiencies which were not addressed. This bill actually addresses some of those deficiencies and plugs that hole on black and blue rockfish, so we don't have essentially the opportunity for people to jump into the black and blue rockfish fishery and take it to a level that's non-sustainable in the long term. I don't disagree with the previous testifiers, Ray Monroe, on some of the transferability issues. We're not trying to kick people out of the fishery or not allow people to participate in the fishery that has historically done so. And I do think that the incidental allowance has to be looked at, too. I think the bill is certainly can make those accommodations. But I think this bill is very necessary. Right now we have a nearshore fishery of the live fish fishery, which had a certain amount of capacity. Due to the recent nearshore plan actions by the department, the landings have been decreased. That leaves more infrastructure available to hold live fish than is necessary for the other species, cabazon, greenling, lingcod, and so on. So we now have the possibility of having and developing a live fish fishery for black and blue rockfish, which could provide an economic incentive for a lot of additional effort. That's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to balance here a sustainable long-term fishery to provide economic value to the coastal communities against it not allowing a completely free access and essentially a boomer-bust fishery. So I think with amendments, this bill is very necessary, and I thank you for taking your time. And I'm sure, like Representative Krieger, you'll be sick of black and blue rockfish before this is over.
Thank you, Mr. Boley. And Mr. Brown?
Thank you. There's a big sign here that says, don't move the microphones. I hope you can hear me.
First of all.
I'm Ralph Brown from Brookings, Oregon. I started fishing when I was 8 years old. I've got two boats now, neither of which fish in this fishery, and have no intention of ever fishing in this fishery. By way of reference, I'm also a Curry County Commissioner, and I've been a member of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council for a little over 7 years. You'll hear later that I was also Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and I was on the Governor's Task Force for Marine Resources. Before that, I've been involved in fisheries management for about 20 years. I want you to know I'm speaking for myself, not for any of the other groups, and I don't have a dog in this fight other than an interest in good fishery management. I'm here to support the passage of this bill, however, and I'm not going to speak to the specifics, but I do want to speak to the need for the legislation. The Pacific Fisheries Management Council is the federal management authority for ocean fisheries off the coast of Oregon and Washington, California. As such, we have been involved in management of groundfish resources along with the states. As an individual member of that council, I have urged the states to become more actively involved in the nearshore fisheries that this bill would deal with. Through an oversight in our federal groundfish limited entry program, the nearshore fisheries in Oregon have the potential for large expansions in the number of participants and therefore have a great potential in becoming overfished. And I would like to diverge just for a minute here. Senator Dukes is absolutely wrong when she says we don't limit wheat farmers. We absolutely do limit wheat farmers. I can guarantee I can't go over and grow wheat on your wheat farm. In fisheries parlance, we would call that an individual fishery, our individual quota system on ground with permanent duration and relatively mobile transferability. It certainly is a limited entry system. And in fact, if you look at any resource, fisheries are the only ones that people say we shouldn't have limited entry on. It's just astounding. You actually get called some pretty nasty names if you advocate for limited entry programs, and yet we consider limited entry programs the basis for the American way in everything else we do. Anyway. The species that make up the nearshore fisheries are a minor component of the groundfish fisheries that the Pacific Fishery Management Council manages. We manage over 100 species of fish. The workload for the council, however, is such that we are forced to concentrate on the larger fisheries. Therefore, we give insufficient attention to the nearshore. Also, the nearshore fisheries tend to be local in nature. Different areas have very different conditions and very different fleet compositions. You heard Janice Green mention the recreational fishery. That changes the percentage of recreational catch, et cetera, up and down the coast. I would point out that recreational catches are 90% of the black rockfish on the coast. We're talking about not only a small portion of the fish that we manage, but the commercial portion is extremely small on top of that. States are able to deal with the local nature of this fishery. The federal government cannot. We are going to end up making a one-size-fits-all rule that doesn't fit anything. The result is, on a federal level, we have a fishery in jeopardy of overfishing that doesn't get the management attention that it needs. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife recognizes the potential for the problems in the fishery and is trying to manage the fishery by using Oregon's Developmental Fishery Program. I know a lot about the Oregon Developmental Fishery Program. I wrote the original bill for it that eventually, of course, got modified and became the program. And while this may be the only tool that ODF&W has at the time, it's certainly stretching the point of the Developmental Fishery Program. The intention of the Developmental Fishery Program is just that, developmental. And this fishery is not developmental anymore. It's completely developed. And, in fact, the Developmental Fishery Program calls for this kind of bill once the developmental fishery has been fully developed. So that's what this does, is it finishes the management of this fishery and becomes a permanent management program and fulfills the requirements of the Developmental Fishery Bill. So in summary, the nearshore fishery is a fishery that is in need of management but is neglected by current management. The management tool available to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Developmental Fishery Program, is not intended for this type of fishery management and is adequate for developing a long-term management program. And therefore, we need this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Appreciate your being with us today. Is that all? With that, colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3108 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3534. And the chair would like to have John Griffith and Anna choosing his point. And gentlemen, we are going to try to get as far as we can here today. We would appreciate as much brevity as is possible. We're not going to obviously be able to move the bill today, as you're aware, and you will have the opportunity to add to the testimony when we bring it back.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ono Husing. I'm the director of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association, representing ports, cities, counties, and soil and water conservation districts on the Oregon coast. I am on OPAC, and I've provided you written testimony. I would want to say one thing. There are Bill Bradbury has a lot of institutional memory on this. I may be one of the only individuals that potentially has a claim of having even more institutional memory on this issue than Bill, because I served on a group in when I was at the University of North Carolina before the bill happened, before I even moved to Oregon, that worked on the first state ocean plan. So there is even a life before Senate Bill 630.
And maybe even before Bill Bradbury was in the legislature?
Well, no, he was in the he was here in the Capitol as a legislator. So I can't predate I don't pretend to predate his interest in that. There are a lot of people that want to testify here today. I think Representative Krieger was more interested in having John and I, or at least me, provide a cleanup function on any testimony that was made earlier. I just wanted to point out one thing that and it's in the written testimony, that what the major thing this bill does is it fences off the fisheries management function, which is the heart and soul of having closed areas to fishing, and takes that out of the Goal 19 exercise and places it with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. That's not to say that OPAC wouldn't continue to work on marine reserve issues. It just does not provide that chain of events that Representative Flores was inquiring about. I mean, it's not quite right to say OPAC is just an advisory committee when it is the major place, as we currently have right now in the system, to develop a territorial sea management plan. And when that management plan is voted on by OPAC and it goes to the Land Conservation Development for Action, well, yeah, we're advisory, but we're the only game in town. And then, and basically there's a history of deference on the part of the Land Conservation and Development to OPAC, as it should be in some respects. So that's one of the things that, as we got into finally having a very contentious vote last August, that's why I meant many of us concentrate on the voting structure and the structure of these statutes, because for a long time OPAC didn't do very much and it never generated controversy. So when it steered into the contentious marine reserve issue, that's when a lot of people said, hey, when was the last time you looked at the OPAC statute? And what are the real working parts on how this advisory committee actually functions, forwards recommendations on to the governor, and takes actions on the territorial sea management plan? So that's one of the reasons we're here today, is that an otherwise sleepy little advisory committee started taking on a subject that could have enormous impact for coastal communities, good and bad. And we're going to have this dialogue on marine reserves continue. So people should understand that people in coastal communities, our hearts are in the right place. We want to try this on for size. We just want an even playing field when we go forward. And we think the changes that are proposed really provide a measure of comfort so that our people will go forward with this and feel like we're having our concerns met. So there's one other little technical point here. This Goal 19 that you've heard about, nothing in this bill would undermine the ability for Goal 19 to still make sure that the preference for renewable resources is upheld. No one on the coast or anywhere is quarreling with that original policy of having a preference for renewable resources. So what it does is, if I have a new proposed use in the territorial sea, let's say I want to have an ocean outfall or a mining venture, something new, that Goal 19 function still asks state agencies that have permitting authority, Division of State Lands, or if it's DEQ for an ocean outfall, says, hey, ultimately, can you authorize that other state agency? Can you authorize that permit? And can we be sure that it's not going to come at the expense of the long-term renewable nature of those resources and hurt our fisheries? So that Goal 19 function is still important for coastal communities, and we're not out to try to sabotage that in any way. But what the bill will do is take the fisheries management function, which is not new uses of the territorial sea that could potentially impact fisheries. Fisheries management is its own discrete function, and that's what the bill does, is it carves that off and basically makes the point that fisheries management complies with Goal 19, because the whole point of fisheries management are our statutes to have renewable resources over time. So it's like, well, yeah, it already complies with Goal 19. Goal 19 was for those special times when you had new uses that were potentially conflicting with the territorial sea. So we've created a path under the bill, and there'll be some amendments, but I think there's no doubt that coastal communities have the most interest in Goal 19, making sure that if there are new proposed unforeseen uses of the territorial sea, that we have a system in place to make sure that Fish and Wildlife, when they give an opinion on this, is going to be listened to. And they ultimately say, no, that ocean outfall or that marine mining or that wind who knows what the potential uses of the territorial sea, that we have a place in state government that can say, no, we're not going to allow that permit to happen because it comes at the expense of our renewable resources. So obviously, I could talk about this forever. You got other great people in the room that came from as far away as Curry County and John Griffith. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to suggest you move on to John's testimony, and I'll stay back and hang out for any rebuttal testimony as needed.
Thank you. And for all of the folks, we've got a number of people who are with are farther than 100 miles, and we're going to try to accommodate all of those. And as I do the quick arithmetic, that's about 4 minutes a person. And understand that we'll be back, and I know this is near and dear to many of your hearts, and we will make sure that everything that you have and need to say will be heard by the committee. But if you could, try to hold yourself to about 4 minutes. Mr. Griffith.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen. My name is John Griffith. I'm the chairman of the board of the Coosa County Board of Commissioners and been a lifelong ocean person. I prepared my testimony in the motel last night, so I'm not going to read it to you because I can't read it myself. It basically, it's Oregon has a major problem with the way its state laws are currently written to delegate authorities in the ocean. The one I want to read you, it's just quite bizarre. This is in the law that deals with Ocean Policy Advisory Council, which is found in the ORS 196s. This is ORS 196-435. It says, the provisions of ORS 196-405 to 515 and blah, blah, blah do not change statutorily and constitutionally mandated responsibilities of other state agencies, period. However, state agencies shall amend their programs and rules relevant to ocean resources to be consistent with the Oregon Ocean Resources Management Plan and the Territorial Sea Plan adopted by LCDC. So that's one of the things that Representative Krieger would like to fix. I would hate to be, for example, on the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission and have before me a discussion on closing off a big zone of the ocean to fishing when I know I've got that law hanging out. You've got to have a hearing and pretend to be impartial and even-handed and all this stuff, and you know the outcome's a foregone conclusion because of 196-435. The Secretary of State, I was really glad Bill was here because he does know an awful lot about this stuff. He was here for the whole ride. The way it works out is OPAC, I was on it for 3 years, it makes recommendations to change the territorial sea plan. LCDC can either adopt it in toto or remand part of it, but it cannot change it. So it's not just a sort of a quiet little knitting circle of advisors by any stretch of the imagination. They've got quite a bit of authority. And then there's another point. At ORS 196-448, that's still the whole OPAC section, Prend 3, in accordance with applicable provisions of ORS 183-310 to 550, which is, you know, model rules, fiscal statements, and all that, it says, in accordance with applicable provisions of ORS them, the Council may adopt rules necessary for the administration of the laws that the Council is charged with administering. But here's a group of governor appointees. To this point, there's been no Senate confirmation or anything else, and it can adopt all the OARs it wants. In my notes, I wrote, these are strange laws, but I think I already got you that. The other part of the problem is in the historic and current operations of OPAC. I was a newspaper reporter. I was a Southern Coast correspondent for the Oregonian from 1989 to 1999, and in 1994 it developed a territorial sea plan. It had only one meeting where there was a public draft for people to look at. I covered the meeting. There was 80 people there. It was down in band, and about 22 of them spoke, and they said, hey, don't do this to us. OPAC went off to Newport the next month and adopted it in toto. With this Marine Reserve Bill, and this is not specifically a Marine Reserve Bill, I'm talking about process, policy, and consistency of state legal theory. It had five meetings. Let's see, maybe four. No, five. Brookings, Port Orford, North Bend, Newport, and Astoria. I went to the the three on the south coast and watched a videotape of the one at Newport and heard about the one in Astoria. There was like 250 guys who showed up at Brookings, and it just simmered along at just a little lower than a full-out riot. People were furious that all their testimony up to this point, and OPEC had done a lot of work and invited a lot of guests, was just being ignored in the draft of the marine reserves. They had said things like, leave us with fishing regulations. We understand them. They're flexible. You know, we know what those things are. But don't practice fisheries management through zoning. As Ono mentioned, statewide land use goals 1 through 19 are the standards by which you review permits for new uses, for land uses. Fishing regulations, no more than elk hunting, are land use decisions. They should not be considered under Oregon's land use system. Someone wanted to site a new ocean outfall or build a pier out there or something. Well, then we'll check it out with goal 19. I'm a county commissioner. I know how it works.
Could you
but
quickly?
That's about it for now.
Well, thank you, Don. And we'll be hearing from you, I'm sure.
Yes,
Cam.
You will.
Thank you. Next, we have Dennis Green and Dennis Riley. And would Lucille Labonte, is that correct? Please come up to.
Go ahead, Denny.
What's wrong? What do you want?
We'll make this very brief. Dennis Ritchie, Oregon Anglers, and Janice Green from the Recreational Fishing Alliance. Our written testimony will be submitted. We will not go over that. We just have a few points. ODFW does have the science and the scientists to make these determinations. LCDC does not have people with fisheries background on the board. So therefore, when OPAC makes recommendations, as was mentioned, either they adopt them or they reject them. And it's not likely that they're going to reject them in most cases. So basically, they do dictate action, as Senator Duke said. Also, ODFW can and does move very quickly to change harvest quotas by emergency. It can be done in a matter of a couple of weeks. If you move through the LCDC system, you're not going to get any actions done in a couple of weeks. I'll guarantee you. As a planning commissioner, I have sat for a year and a half waiting for LCDC to get back to us. And our stock management cannot wait for decisions like that. Basically, that's it.
Thank you. Dennis?
Oh, I guess I'm left here all alone. Well, good afternoon, or good morning still. Chair Jensen, I appreciate you giving me the time. I'm going to read a brief statement from the Curry County Board of Commissioners. I'm Lucy Labonte, Chair of the Curry County Board of Commissioners. And then I want to go into a real brief bit of history as far as OPAC as well, because I've been there since the beginning as well as my former Senator Bradbury, now Secretary of State. The Curry County Board of Commissioners supports House Bill 3534. Other proposed activities within the territorial sea affect fisheries management and impact coastal economies. Goal 19 clearly gives the living resources a priority. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is responsible for living resources within the state's territorial sea. Therefore, we believe that the Ocean Policy Advisory Board should be located and staffed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Oregon Legislature should provide ODFW with the resources to carry out the staffing of the Coastal Policy Advisory Council. And just I'll clarify that because one of my commissioners wondered about that. There is federal money that comes down through the Ocean Coastal Policy folks in D.C. to staff and carry out these types of functions that can be used for that. So that money wouldn't be coming from the state. It would be passed through the state legislature. But we want to make sure that it goes to ODFW and doesn't stay with DLCD for that particular function. We support the proposed membership of the Oregon Coastal Policy Council. Recommendations by this council could directly affect coastal community economies. Therefore, we support adding local government representatives to the council. The brief history I wanted to give you is that back in the early 90s, I was the on-the-ground person in Curry County working on the issue of offshore oil drilling, mineral mining, and I authored a study, a portion of a study for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, what the impacts worldwide were on those industries to the fishing community, and they were quite substantial. And that's how I got involved in fisheries at all. Most people think my husband was a fisherman, but he wasn't. That's how I got involved. I became very concerned about our fisheries. I noticed that the staff at DLCD are the same staff that were there then. They started pushing marine reserves back then. I was very appalled at a meeting in Brookings, one of the ones that John Griffith referred to, when one of the staff members actually told the public in Brookings that the fishermen on the North Coast were in favor of marine reserves. He was referring to actually one fisherman in particular who is a former state representative, and when that individual found out, he was furious. I raised my hand because I had gotten a briefing of the Newport meeting from Anno Husing, and he told me something different, and I raised my hand and said, excuse me, that's not what I'm hearing, and that individual backed off and changed his story. This is in front of about 250 people in the Brookings fishing community who were enraged. That's why people were angry. That is the type of thing that's been happening on OPAC with the staffing under DLCD, and I'm just being honest here. I was told not to really bring this kind of thing up, but you know what? I'm a very upfront person, and we have a real problem with this kind of state government agency fooling around. We really do, and that is one reason I feel that we're better off under ODFW. They are our fish managers. This is a fish management issue when it comes to marine reserves, and we really need to have the fish managers taking care of it, not land managers that want to zone out our fishermen in our state territorial sea. So that's my aside. Just to let you know that I'm being honest with you about that.
You're impeccable on the timing, so
thank you,
Mr. Chair.
And thank you so much.
I just have to make one comment. I don't care what issue we're talking about here, anywhere in this building. That's exactly the kind of stuff I want to hear. I don't want anyone to be afraid to say anything in this room.
Well, good.
I just want to share that.
I appreciate it. And I tell you, there's a lot of fish friends here in the audience. We all differ on fisheries issues, but fish are our gold out in the ocean, and we really believe it, Matt, and we want to make it right for our fishermen.
And that's what we're
thank you very much, Janice. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then next we would have Scott McMuller, Terry Thompson, and Ralph Brown again, please.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott McMullen. I'm a lifelong commercial fisherman from Astoria, currently serving as chairman of the Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee. I'm the North Coast Commercial Fisherman Representative on OPAC, and as such, I was appointed as chair of the Marine Protected Area Working Group that studied this marine reserve issue for OPAC and delivered a report to OPAC, which then passed on a recommendation to the governor. In my 3 years on OPAC, one of the frustrations that I had was a lack of balance. The coastal interests seem like, to me, are not adequately represented. So I think the intent of this legislation is to change process so that the coastal interests have an equal say or more of a say in the decisions that affect us. I agree with Secretary Bradbury, Senator Dukes, in a change that would allow the state agency people to be advisory, ex officio, rather than voting members. In the very controversial vote on marine reserves, I think it was the representative from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries that abstained, indicating really he didn't have a good vote to make on this issue, and I think we need to recognize that there's cases where state agency directors should be advisory. One of the things that came out in all of our studies on marine reserves was that you need stakeholder buy-in. We kept hearing that. You have to have the people that are on the ocean buy in if these reserves are going to be successful. As a fisherman representative, we tried to incorporate elements into the marine reserve recommendation that would allow there to be a successful buy-in by the fishing fleet, and time and time again we were voted down. The couple votes of commercial fishermen and recreational fishermen were voted out each time. So that's why I think we just need to change the process a little bit. There's many good things that have come out of OPAC. I just think we need to tweak it a little bit so that it's a little more balanced. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You want to go?
Mr. Brown.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Ralph Brown from Brookings, Oregon. Member of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, also Curry County Commissioner. I'm speaking for myself here, not for either of those groups. I was on the original Governor's Task Force for Marine Resources that I think Bill Bradbury spoke about that gave the recommendation to establish OPAC. The rationale for that was that in looking at working with the Governor's Task Force, we identified gaps in authority and also the potential for mixed projects that needed some work, and we needed a coordinating body for things like the marine cables it might cross several different authorities, and no one really had a clear authority to take the lead. So one of the things that OPAC was supposed to do was develop that line of authority, identify the lead agency, and help to coordinate. That's why public agencies were put on it as voting members. The other thing we identified were some gaps in authority. I don't think we ever really cleared up the gaps in authority. One that I remember was ocean floor was under authority of Division of State Lands from low tide line down. From the high tide line up, the parks were under authority and nobody had anything in between. Another one was ODF&W that dealt with the animal life in the ocean. Kelp harvest was given to Division of State Lands and nobody deals with the other plants. I don't know if that's ever been cleared up. So we had these problems that needed to be dealt with, primarily the coordination aspect that we're talking about. The body was clearly intended to be advisory and coordinating, not to be regulatory, and it clearly was not to replace lines of clear authority. When it applies to fisheries, ODF&W has a very clear line of authority. OPAC doesn't belong in it. All this bill does is clarify that, doesn't change it. One of the things that we did then after we recommended that, of course, OPAC got passed, and I was also the first on the first version of it. I was the only public member that actually served on both bodies, and we worked on the Territorial Sea Plan. I wish I could claim authorship. I can't. I had some input, but somebody else wrote it. But it's been, I think it was said 91 or 93, and John maybe 94. It's been a few years, and it sure seems to me that it makes some sense to review it. But one of the things I remember is the youth priorities, for example, that were in the original plan. And we've got an interesting situation where the plan called for the number one use for marine resources off the coast of Oregon as being to look at them. Basic human needs were not even considered. And we really do need to go back and examine those kinds of provisions. At the time, it seemed like it makes sense. It actually says non-consumptive uses. The rationale was that if we didn't use them, we could save them for things that did use them. The fact of the matter is if you're using a use priority, the only non-consumptive use basically is to go look at it or perhaps hold it and feel it or something, you know. But I think we really need to consider that and put it into terms of some human needs, too. So the bill does that too. It requires a reexamination of the plan, so that makes some sense. And then finally, the consideration for people that live on the coast. I was testifying at a kind of a closed meeting with some people in front of the Presidential Ocean Commission I don't know if it's last year or the year before now. And somebody from Portland actually made the statement to them that she certainly hoped that they wouldn't pay too much attention to the provincials that live on the coast. I couldn't get over to tip her chair over, but I probably would have had I been able to. The rationale for many of the things we did was that the oceans belong to the people of Oregon. That's true. And people in Portland and people in Lamont Valley and Eastern Oregon use them for the playground. But there are homes. I certainly hope that you will keep the provisions of this bill that gives some consideration to us people who are trying to deal with our homes. And finally, the last, it's apparently we're not clear if it's in the bill or out of the bill, moving it from Department of Land Conservation into ODF&W. I don't have real strong feelings on that. However, I do think that one thing that could do is identify a clear ocean agency to deal with ocean things. I spoke earlier about ODF&W not having authority over the plants, for example, and yet many of the things that they're doing now on the federal level are dealing with that whole integrated ecosystem kinds of management issues where they are going to need authority to deal with the entire ocean system, not just with the animals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown.
Thank you. Terry Thompson, County Commissioner and ex-legislators.
Might put a prelude to this. One of the testimonies earlier was giving somebody credit for all they knew about fish, and I guess that would be the chair's comment to the commissioner, having served with him in the first couple of sessions here.
And vice versa. I know a little more about wheat farms than I did when I started serving with you. I'm going to make mine very simple. I wanted to thank Wayne Krieger for bringing this bill forward. This is an issue which has been festering on the coast for almost 4 years now. There's been a lot of hard work gone into ocean policy. I think that there were some things that were done inappropriately. I think this bill will straighten out part of those things. I'm sure with the people that are here today, and I was surprised when I walked into the room, I see a lot of the experts on the ocean sitting behind you. You may not realize it, but they are really the experts. And the fact that we're all here today, if we sit down and make some minor amendments to it, I think this bill should go forward. I wanted to clear up one thing. There was a comment about LCDC and their roles of undersea cables. It's not necessarily related to this bill, but LCDC, the laws may have helped us get there, but it was basically the fishermen who had to try to lead the cable community and the land use people in how to make this function. It has been one of the success stories, and I hope the same thing will be true in the issue of marine reserves. Let the fishermen, let the people that are experts in biology lead this process, and I think you'll have a winner.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, while you're changing, can you indulge me just for 30 seconds, please?
I don't have 30 seconds, but I'll give you 15.
Thank you. I just want to, being a representative of, I live in Happy Valley, but I also, 85% of my constituents live in Portland. And I love Portland, but I want to personally apologize to you, sir, and I want to tell you that not everyone in Portland feels that way about folks that live in rural communities. I certainly am not one of them. I want to apologize to you. It's that kind of attitude that creates this huge gap we have between rural and urban. And I want to get rid of that. Thank you.
Story lies on it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you. I do appreciate that, although sometimes we do feel like we're getting run over here from the great state of Portland as people down in the colonies. So thank you.
So it is Portland's fault. I knew that.
I have Robin Hartman. And Robin, please be very brief because we're complete out of time. We want to hear one other bill for some folks who've come a long way.
Chair Jansen and members of the committee, I'm not the most knowledgeable person from the conservation community on this bill, but I happen to have driven the farthest today. So my name's Robin Hartman. I come from Roseburg, Oregon, and I am a board member of Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, as well as a legislative chair and Douglas County Coast Watch chair. Our organization has about 1,000 members statewide, and we were formed 30 years ago when the Beach Bill, which protects our public access, was enacted. Our mission is to protect Oregon's coastal environment and the public trust therein. Oregon Shores opposes HB 3534 as written. One of the reasons we oppose it is it removes the protection and management effect of the territorial sea plan. It also would disrupt, if not condemn, Oregon's three-year education and involvement process to consider establishment of marine reserves. It would also undermine Goal 19, which protects Oregon's nearshore environment and continental shelf. It would also place ocean management almost entirely into the hands of one interest group. There are other concerns we have with the bill. We are aware that Representative Krieger has been working with his constituents and other statutory agencies and interest groups in amending the bill. We applaud his effort, and we really understand his interest in helping with stakeholder buy-in on the coast. And we appreciate that in the past he's had successes in developing effective compromises. We would like to work with him to help inform coastal residents about the process for considering marine reserves. And in fact, our president, Oregon Shores president, is leading a workshop today on the coast talking more about being involved in the marine reserves process. If an amendment is crafted, I have listed a few items here that we'd support to have in an agreement in an amended version of the bill. And the first one is that the Territorial Sea Plan, we believe, should remain the mechanism for implementing Goal 19. Secondly, Oregon should be allowed to coordinate with adjacent state and federal governments regarding ocean resource management. Thirdly, the Oregon Coast Management Program responsibilities for Goals 16, 17, 18, and 19 should remain with DLCD. Fourth, we support OPAC remaining with DLCD. We also believe that if there are changes made in to reduce the membership of OPAC and make it more manageable, that the new composition should be balanced and balanced for all interests and for all of Oregon. And six, we support the clarification in law that OPAC would be prohibited from taking any action to establish fishing seasons, harvest allocations, geographic restrictions, or other harvest restrictions. That's currently unclear in statute, and it needs clarification that authority belongs to ODFW. Pretty much it?
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And colleagues, with that, and I know there are some of you came to sign or signed up to testify on this bill that I haven't called. I've called the people who were generally 100 miles or more away, and those that are closer, we apologize to you. We will have another public hearing on this before we get to a work session, so the time gets away from us. I do have another bill that I have to hear for a little bit here this morning, so we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3534 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3094. And we have, and I get to Pete just a minute on this, but I have four people from over 100 miles away. If y'all would just come forward, John Westerholm, I think it is, Kim Van Sager, Brenda Wall, and Todd Jones.
Read this,
please.
House Bill 3094 allows direct retail sale of fish caught by persons holding commercial fishing license at any location.
Please. We're still in session. Keep the comments down while you're here. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, I didn't know you were planning to testify too, so I'm...
Mr. Chair, all I was going to do was to thank you for your courtesy in hearing this bill and then get out of the way.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
That's the best testimony we've heard all day.
Please go ahead. I'm sorry, I don't know your name, so just introduce yourself for the record. And
okay, I am John Westerholm from the CRFPU. That stands for Columbia River Fishermen's Protective Union in Astoria. We are the major sponsors with Representative Johnson on this bill. We feel that that this is a good bill. It's a good bill for us. It's a good bill for the state. It's a good bill for the fishing industry. And that's a good bill for the consumer. And our purpose for asking for more direct sales of commercially caught salmon, Columbia River salmon, that is, to the consumer at any location, as this bill reads, as amended, is basically threefold. I guess I just got through saying that, but to be able to generate a more viable income for the individual fisherman, to provide a quality salmon product directly to the consumer, to assist in providing for our local and statewide struggling economy. The last 3 years, for a number of reasons, we have seen a marvelous increase in certain salmon stocks. At the same time, fall salmon prices have dropped dramatically, including one of our favorite fall fish, a coho, to where it is questionable that the commercial fisher can make a profit at what he is able to sell the fish for to the processor, with his investment in his gear and the time that he has to spend to prepare for that fishery. We actually started to lay the groundwork for this action behind this bill back in 2001 at our annual CRFPU meeting. In September of that year, we made a statement, quote, statement, by keeping our boats at the dock with only a few going out and the catch going to the needy in Portland, Salem, and Olympia. Maybe some of you remember that we got a little bit of press on that at the time. The culmination of low prices at that time, we thought, had reached the bottom. It can do nothing but go up, but it hasn't. A little bit maybe, but very slow. And I should point out that Washington State is doing the same thing that we're doing. They're working on a bill of the same nature, maybe not exactly the same, but we've kind of checked on some of the things that we're asking for on each side of the river. After all, our commercial fishermen are up and down the river, both sides, and we want to try to work on this as equally as possible. And there are Washington as well as Oregon members in our organization. Some of our people that are testifying here this morning, of course, are not commercial fishermen. So we have a fairly good group of people from the Astoria area to talk about certain areas, how this could help them and help the community. In my conclusion, we concur that the amended bill with the four-year pilot program for the Columbia River would be the most advantageous and easiest to manage. With the large run of cohos predicted for the Columbia this fall and Young's Bay as well, it is imperative to get the emergency amendment on this bill, because otherwise it won't happen in time for us for this fall to take advantage of it. So we encourage the committee to pass this bill with the amendments that it has. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing us to speak here today. My name is Chuck Hagland. I'm speaking about marketing and the direct sale of fish. Direct marketing of commodities has become more common, especially in these uncertain economic times. Direct marketing concepts allow for producers to convey product to the consuming public. Many producers in Oregon currently engage in direct sales marketing plans for most agricultural and seafood products. Demand for wild salmon and value-added salmon products is growing. Commercial fishermen and their families are experiencing a disconnect from traditional marketing structures and have experienced some success with the current method of selling off their boats. This activity is creating more demand for salmon and value-added salmon products across the state. Restaurants are asking for wild salmon, and consumers are becoming educated to the health benefits of this valuable commodity. Direct These rapidly growing niche markets are being shadowed by commodities marketing institutions that allow participants to access a wealth of information regarding direct sales marketing, advertising, and business plan development. These developing infrastructures may help to alleviate the loss of the historical traditional infrastructure that is falling and rotting into the Columbia River. The fish represents our connection to the citizens of Oregon. By fishermen having the ability to create new value for their fish, they will be able to help revitalize the staggering Columbia River economy. Direct sales plans focus on local sales. Oregonians are loyal to their state and to their products and to their resources. This bill will allow commercial fish harvesters to bring this most valuable resource back home to American consumers, to Oregon consumers, excuse me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Jensen, my name is Todd Jones. I'm the project director for CEDC Fisheries Project. This project over the last 20 Jones. Years, yes.
I see you have written testimony, so could you just summarize it?
Yes. I will not read it all.
Thank you.
The reason I'm here is purely selfish. Our project that produces about 5 million smolt a year and releases them in the Columbia River results in a harvest of close to 80,000 fish a year by the commercial fleet, another 20,000 fish by the recreational fishers in the ocean and buoy 10 and in the river and in our terminal areas. This amounts to about $750,000 ex vessel input directly to the fishermen and about a $2.5 million total economic impact to our region. There are three things that can affect the potential future of this project. Part of our funding comes directly from the state of Oregon through a direct appropriation. Part of it comes from the R&E funds that are collected from sport fishermen's licenses. And a significant portion comes from Bonneville Power Administration. But leveraging all of that is a 5% voluntary assessment by the commercial fishermen who harvest all those fish when they return to the terminal area. And then that is matched by the processors to whom they sell the fish. Now, speaking purely for the protection of this project, if we lose support from the state, either in the form of funding or for perhaps taking a narrow look at this particular bill and don't allow the expansion of our markets for those fish, we're going to lose support from Bonneville Power Administration, and that's critical to us. And we also can lose support locally if all the fishermen don't participate in that because the amount of money they pay in gets more and more critical to them when the fish prices go down. And if we don't have the local processors fully committed to participating as well. Those things are coming together nicely. We'll have nearly 100% participation by the local fleet and the processors. But I think it's only fair that the fishermen be able to maximize where benefits or where opportunities lie for them to quadruple or even times 10 times their income on their fish through some direct sales. And I don't see this as pitting the fishermen against the processors. My brief experience of 20 years in Alaska, the gillnetters up there were able to quadruple their income by dressing their fish aboard their boats and selling directly to their own markets. And it never hurt one of the processors. So I think that's, in some minds, a false dichotomy. And we would like to see, at least I would like to see this experiment, this four-year trial, go into effect to see if, in fact, it doesn't benefit the total industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there somebody?
Yes, I'm in.
We'll make a minute here. Yes.
Hello, my name is Brenda Wall, and I want to thank you very much for your time. And I'm a wife of a fisherman, and I just wanted to encourage you to vote for this bill to pass because it is really going to affect the families And each of the fishermen really are a small business without a storefront. So this is going to open up a whole new realm for us with direct marketing, and we're really excited about it. And it's really going to be a boost to all those tiny little communities that dot the Columbia that you really don't think about when you're heading to the coast. So I just really want to encourage you, and I also have written my piece that I was going to share, but I don't want to take your time.
Thank you very much, Brenda. We appreciate this, and your testimony will be a part of the record for us on this bill.
Thanks.
So we appreciate it. Is there anyone of the others at work? Okay. Thank you, folks, for coming this distance. Sorry that you kind of got cut a little close on the time, but we appreciate your testimony and appreciate your concerns. With that, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3094, and with that, we are adjourned.